This is the Weather Lounge here at WeatherWorks.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Weather Lounge. I'm your host, meteorologist Brad Miller, joined with my co-host, Mike Mihalik. And, of course, we come to you from our WeatherWorks headquarters located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. And as you probably know, we have another solar eclipse coming our way this year, and that will be visible across much of the United States in just a few weeks, April 8th, to be exact, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one we've been waiting for a while now, ever since we had the solar eclipse, the total solar eclipse. I think it was almost 7 years ago now, back in 2017. I've been waiting for this one. I think back in 2017 here in eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey, I can't remember exactly how much of the sun was covered at that point. It might have been like 70% or something like that. I can't remember offhand, but excited for this one. I just hope the clouds hold off.
And I know a lot of folks from here at WeatherWorks are gonna make the trip out to like western New York, western Pennsylvania. Of course, that's where the path of totality will be. So we're kind of looking forward to some video from our fellow meteorologists that are going to make that trip. And and as we get closer to that first week of April, we thought it wouldn't be apropos to have a guest on today's episode that has a lot more knowledge about solar eclipses than just us lowly meteorologists, Mike.
Well, rather than us talking about the solar eclipse, why not have Paul Bryans talk about it? And he is a project scientist for NCAR at the High Altitude Observatory. We'll bring him on right after this break, and he'll talk all about the solar eclipse. So we can't wait to talk to him. So everybody, don't go away.
Hey everyone, it's Mike Prianti from the Weather Lounge here, and let me tell you, dehydration is no joke. I went through it myself once, and it's not fun. You get headaches, muscle spasms, cramps, the whole nine yards. But proper, functional hydration is essential for just about everyone. Sometimes, though, water may not be enough, and that's where Liquid IV comes in. They're the number one powdered hydration brand in America, and their hydration multiplier is something you're most likely missing in your daily routine. You don't even have to be a sports professional to enjoy it either. With just one stick, you can hydrate twice as fast than using water alone. It has three times the amount of electrolytes than leading sports drinks, it's made from non-GMO ingredients, and it's chock full of essential vitamins. I personally enjoy the passion fruit flavor, but there are other great refreshing flavors you can choose from as well. So whether you're out landscaping, plowing a parking lot in a snowstorm, heading out for that afternoon jog, or even just feeling run down, Liquid IV is your go-to source for all hydration and wellness. Get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code WEATHERLOUNGE, capital W, capital L, at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code WEATHERLOUNGE at liquidiv.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to the Weather Lounge. And, of course, today's topic is all about the big solar eclipse that will be occurring really across the United States on April 8th. And our guest today is Paul Bryans. And as Mike had mentioned before the break, he is a project scientist at the High Altitude Observatory at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, better known as NCAR. So, Paul, welcome to the Weather Lounge. And give us a little background about yourself.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here. So I am a scientist at NCAR, and I research the sun. More specifically, I'm interested in how the sun affects life on Earth. So in some sense, I'm kind of the equivalent of you guys, but instead of predicting Earth weather, I'm trying to predict space weather.
Yeah, that's definitely a different topic, that's for sure. I mean, some people like to ask us as meteorologists, things about the sun, but...
And meteors, too.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah. but, it seems like they always think that we know about, what's going on with the sun, what's going on with space things, astronomy, space weather. And while I do follow it from time to time, I'm in no way an expert on that. I mean, like you said, we're following weather systems here on Earth. We don't really know much about the sunspots and the coronal mass ejections and the solar winds and how it affects the planet. That's your expertise. So we're glad to have you with us today.
Glad to be here.
So I think the big question here, we want to talk about the solar eclipse here, Paul. So why don't we just go through quickly basically how the total solar eclipse happens. Many may have an idea, but let's just take our listeners through that a little bit.
So a solar eclipse happens when we have something called syzygy, right? That's just a difficult to spell word that means that the moon, the sun, and the earth line up in a perfect straight line. So in the case of a solar eclipse, the moon is directly between the earth and the sun. And from our perspective on Earth, the moon blocks out the sunlight. So we don't see the surface of the sun anymore. All we see is the atmosphere of the sun that we call the corona. That's different from a lunar eclipse. It's in some sense, it's the exact opposite of a lunar eclipse. A lunar eclipse is also syzygy. But in this case, rather than the moon being between the Earth and the sun, the Earth would be between the moon and the sun. So instead of seeing a bright white full moon, you see a red full moon. And that's because the sunlight has to pass through the Earth's atmosphere before it reflects off the moon. So it looks red to us. And that's a kind of cool thing to see, I guess, but it doesn't even come close to how awesome a solar eclipse is, when the sun like literally disappears from the sky in the middle of the day.
Right. And that's, you already answered the question I had next about anything with the lunar eclipse. And that was, you know, why you don't get the moon to completely black out. So you already answered that as far as the rays in the atmosphere. But the lunar eclipse actually takes a lot longer of a time period than a solar eclipse, correct?
That's right. And that's because the different sizes of the objects, right? The moon is a lot smaller than the Earth. So for a solar eclipse, you have like a small moon passing between the Earth and the sun, and it only blocks out the sun for a short amount of time. For a lunar eclipse, the Earth is blocking out the sunlight from the moon, and the Earth is much bigger than the moon, so that lasts longer.
I always found it so interesting that the moon is the right size and the proper distance from Earth to almost exactly cover the sun. It seems like a very improbable thing. I don't know if it is, but to me, I always looked at that saying like, that is so perfect. How is that possible?
You know, there's no real reason that it should be. It's just, we're just lucky. We are, the Earth is, or the moon is about 400 times smaller than the sun, but it's also 400 times closer than the sun. So those things cancel out, and it is just almost exactly the same size as the sun in the sky. But you know, it's not always true, right? So the moon orbits the Earth, but it doesn't orbit the Earth in a perfect circle. It's an ellipse. So at some parts of that orbit, it is a little bit closer to the Earth than other times. So you only get a total solar eclipse sometimes. If the moon is too far away in its orbit, so it's a little bit farther from the Earth, it looks a bit smaller in the sky from our perspective. And in those cases, you would not get a total solar eclipse. The moon would only block out some of the sunlight. And that's when we get an annular eclipse. So the moon is a little bit smaller than the size of the sun. And you would see, you kind of often hear it referred to as a ring of fire, right? And we had one of those in the US just earlier, just last year.
Okay. And since we're talking about that, I thought it'd be great to kind of talk about the path of totality, even though I want to go through the progression of the solar eclipse first. I thought it'd be good, since we're talking about the sizes of the sun, size of the moon, how big is that swath that totality goes through?
Yeah, and how does it vary between each solar eclipse and things like that? I mean, it's not a standard, it's not a constant path or a constant width, is it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's talk about the eclipse coming up first. In the for the case of the eclipse coming up, it goes from south to north, and it passes through Mexico. Then when it hits the US, it will be in Texas. Then it starts traveling northeast and eventually goes up to Maine and then Canada. And the width of that path of totality, it will be a little over 100 miles, like 110 miles, maybe something like that. But you're right when you say it's not the same for every eclipse. And that's because of what I just spoke about earlier when I said the moon is not always the same distance from the Earth, right? So when the moon is close to us, it's a little bit bigger in the sky. And so that width of the path of totality is a little bit wider. And when the moon is farther away, it's smaller in the sky. And so the width of totality is pretty narrow. So the eclipse coming up in 2024 is kind of like the midpoint.
I was just curious too. I mean, you're talking about it coming through Texas, going up through the Northeast. Now, from a weather standpoint, you try to think of, well, what's the best place to see the eclipse? And around the Great Lakes in April, probably not the best place to be. I'm hoping that we get lucky and it's one of a cloudless day. But typically you have northwest winds, you know, clouds coming off the lakes, you know, low pressure systems going across. So from a weather standpoint, I would say likely heading down towards Texas and the plains would be a better place to be. I don't know if there's, I mean, as long as you're within that swath of totality, I don't know if there's a better place to be other than in that width from your standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, for you guys are the experts on the weather, right? And I've so maybe I'll be tuning into your podcast in the days leading up to the eclipse to see where is best to be. I chose to go to Texas just for the reasons you're saying. I think it's the lowest likelihood of cloud cover. Another thing that you might want to consider if you're thinking about traveling for the eclipse is it's great to be anywhere in the path of totality, but the closer to the center line of that path you are, the longer the eclipse will happen. Okay, so if you're close to the edge of it, you might only get a fraction of a minute. But if you're near the center of the totality path, you can get up to 4.5 minutes. So that's one thing to consider about where you locate yourself.
And with the eclipse, I mean, does it have to happen when we're talking about the moon? But it can only happen with a new moon phase. Is this correct?
Yeah, that's right. Because like a full moon, for instance, happens when the moon is farther, is on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun.
It's on the opposite side. Right.
Yeah, and a new moon happens when the moon is between the sun and the Earth. So you have to be you have to be in the new moon phase for an eclipse to happen, but it doesn't mean that every new moon will lead to an eclipse though, because the orbit of the moon is kind of inclined to the plane of the Earth and the sun. So sometimes that new moon can be above or below the path of where the sun is in our sky. So you don't get it every new moon; otherwise, you would get an eclipse every month. We get a solar eclipse on average every 18 months.
Right. And that was actually my next question. How many solar eclipses have we missed? I mean, we miss them obviously because of a full moon versus a new moon, or would it be on the other side of the Earth? I that's kind of what I was getting at. I mean, if it's a full moon on one side, it's a new moon on the other side. So maybe that side gets it and not the side that has the new moon or the full moon.
Well, there would still be an eclipse in the sense that the moon would cast a shadow, right?
Okay, I gotcha.
But for a solar eclipse, we want that shadow to fall on the Earth, right? So sometimes that shadow falls into outer space, right?
Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, every 18 months, you said, it sounds like there's a solar eclipse somewhere. Obviously, it's not always over the U.S. I mean, it could be up near the poles. It can be wherever.
Right. And along those lines, too, Mike, I was going to ask Paul. I said, you know what really makes me, I mean, whenever you think about these things, I mean, the forecast for eclipses are almost 100 years, maybe more. It's almost like I can't fathom how you forecast an eclipse 50, 60, 100 years. I mean, how far out can you actually forecast an eclipse? I mean, it's amazing to me that you could actually see that far ahead.
You know, I think we can. It does seem amazing, right? But we know the orbits of the sun, the earth, and the moon pretty well, and we don't know them absolutely perfectly, so we can't predict eclipses like into the future indefinitely. We can predict them about 1,000 years into the future right now.
But even with the last one, we had the one in 2017, and they already knew. They said, all right, well, the next full solar eclipse will be April 8th, 2024. And that just blows my mind. It's like, okay, we know something that's going to happen 7 years from now. Different path, obviously, but, you know, it's kind of cool to know that kind of
stuff. Yeah, and the next one in the U.S. is in 2045?
That far ahead, huh?
I believe.
That's right. And I'm in Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado, and that one will actually pass right over my house. So I'm looking forward to that one. But you know, that's more than 20 years away. So if you're in the US, you should definitely take the opportunity
Yeah, absolutely. So we already kind of covered with the total solar eclipse how long it takes. You said totality can last anywhere from a few minutes to up to maybe 4 minutes or so. But I know there's a lot of phases the eclipse goes through, from, you know, being a partial eclipse to then getting very close to totality, and then a few interesting things that happen visually when that happens. Can you take us through that a little bit? How it kind of progresses?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how long the whole thing takes, right? The start of the partial eclipse to the end of the partial eclipse, that will take something like 2.5 hours. But the really cool part of it, the totality, that will last about 4.5 minutes. And exactly how long it lasts depends on where you are on the Earth. So that varies. But if we talk about the phases and what actually happens, the first thing that happens is what we call first contact. And that's when you just start to see the moon start to eat out a little chunk of the sun.
Hmm. Right? Like Pac-Man. Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and then gradually the moon covers more and more of the sun. So unless you're looking at the sun, you probably won't even notice this is happening until it gets to maybe 80, 90% totality, because the sun is pretty bright, right? So even when you cover up 70% of it, it doesn't make too much difference. There's still a lot of sunlight. But as the moon covers more and more of the sun, things will gradually start to get colder. They'll gradually start to get darker. Then just as the moon almost covers the full disk of the sun, we get something called Bailey's beads. And what that looks like is little pearls of sunlight that poke out along the edge of the moon. The reason for those is that the moon is not like a perfect sphere. You know that the moon's got a lot of craters on it, right? So it's actually, the edge of the moon is actually kind of rough. And what you're seeing is sunlight passing through those craters, and you see little dots of light on the sun. And then eventually we get the diamond ring, and that's the last of those Bailey's beads, right? That's the very last part of sunlight just sneaking through one of the craters on the moon. And that will only last for a couple of seconds. And then the moon completely covers the sun, and kind of, it's almost suddenly you go from daylight to almost nighttime. And And in that, and then what will happen is, rather than see the surface of the sun, you see the sun's atmosphere. It's called the corona. And it's always there, but we don't see it from the Earth because it is so much dimmer than the sun's surface. So by blocking out the sun's surface, then we see that corona. And then that will last for 4.5 minutes. And then you'll see all the things I spoke about in reverse. You'll see the diamond ring again as the moon moves away from the sun. You'll see Bailey's beads again. And then you'll see all the phases of the partial eclipse until you go back to the normal situation. And that whole process will take about 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you waited all this time and then you only get the cool things to happen within 2 to 4 minutes.
Yeah, 4.5 minutes.
But I've never personally witnessed an eclipse. I've seen videos and stuff like that. I don't know if you have personally viewed an eclipse or a total solar eclipse yourself. I'm just curious, how dark does it really get? Does it go almost to like pitch black during that? Or is it almost like twilight on the horizon or something like that? I just don't know. I mean, I never experienced it.
Yeah, so I've seen two eclipses. The first one was in 2017 when I was in Wyoming. And then I saw one in 2019 where I was on a mountaintop in Chile. And they were both like very different experiences. As far as how dark it gets, it's not pitch black of night. It's more like twilight. But it's also worth saying that it's not like twilight at all. While it's like the same darkness level, it looks very different because the sunlight is not coming from the horizon. It's coming still from the sun, but it's kind of difficult to explain without experiencing it. It's kind of weird. It's natural phenomenon, but it feels very unnatural. Right? It feels like this is something that shouldn't really happen.
Right, and then you wonder why back in ancient times, before we had this type of knowledge of how this happens, why it was such a extraordinary supernatural type event, because they just didn't realize.
Yeah, but if you've experienced a total eclipse, I think you will then maybe not be surprised that ancient people thought that this was some sign of an apocalypse or whatever, right? Because it feels it's not like anything else you normally experience.
It's amazing if I can't remember what the book was, but I read a book the one time where I feel like it was a fiction thing where a time traveler went back in history and then he predicted the eclipse because he knew when it was going to happen and then everybody thought he was some sorcerer or something. I forget what the book was, but he was using all kinds of modern technology back in ancient times. So everybody thought he was this amazing, powerful sorcerer. But it's just that he knew the science of how things worked. But I'm really, I haven't made plans myself to go to the solar eclipse just yet. But I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about if it looks good.
I'm going to say it'll probably be a last-minute decision.
I'm going to drive 3 hours.
If you know it's going to be nice.
And get into the totality path.
I just pull you up on that one because I feel like I hear this a lot from people, right? That either like where I am is 90% totality is good enough, right? Or even where I am is 99% totality is good enough. And it's really not. I think there is literally night and day difference between totality and not. So I encourage you and anyone else that is kind of on the fence about this you should really try and travel to the path of totality.
Yeah, because Mike, you don't know what's going to be happening 20 years from now. I mean,
You're trying to off me already?
No.
I still got a good amount of time left here.
I know, but it may be easier to do this one than 20 years from now.
Oh, come on.
I'd also say, like, I'm a super cynical person mostly. And before I'd seen Total Solar Eclipse before, I had people like me telling me, oh, you got to go and see it. You don't understand how amazing it is. And I was like, meh, sure. I've seen a lunar eclipse before. I've seen partial eclipse. They're not that cool. But it wasn't until I actually saw one that I kind of became a convert and I understood what people were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that makes entire sense. I mean, everybody that I've ever talked to who went to a total solar eclipse has come back and told me it's one of the most amazing things to view. I think actually our CEO, Frank Lombardo, here at WeatherWorks, went there back in 2017.
Yeah, he went to North Carolina, I think, yeah.
Yes, and he just came back and was like, it's just unbelievable experience. So.
Yeah, I think it went across Western North Carolina for that one. So Paul, I know there's a safety aspect to this too. I know you're not supposed to, you know, look directly at the eclipse. I mean, because of that, it's because of the corona, and I guess with your eyes. I mean, I just don't understand. Still, how does that create? How can it burn your retina? I mean, with that kind of setup.
You know, it's no different than any other time. You know, not to look at the sun, right? I kind of we don't. On a daily basis, we usually don't feel the need to tell people don't look directly at the sun, right? It's kind of obvious.
I don't think you can, right? Your body won't let you anymore. But I know when you have the eclipse, apparently, I guess it's okay. You can,
The only difference during the eclipse is that people are maybe more inclined to try and look at the sun. So what you should do is try and get yourself some solar viewing glasses, and they have a filter on them that blocks out the vast majority of the sunlight so that it is then safe to look at the sun. But another thing you can do is try and like make a pinhole projector, right? If you just have a piece of paper.
I've seen them before, yeah.
Yeah. You can put a small hole in it and you can project the sun like onto the ground or onto some other surface and you can see it that way. But this is only true for partial eclipses, right? Once you get to totality, you absolutely should take off your eclipse glasses and look at the sun. This is the only time you should ever look directly at the sun with your eyes, because the corona is so dim that it will not hurt your eyes at all. And you should absolutely look at it. You'll miss all the best things if you don't.
Good to know.
Yeah, that's what I was just rooting around my desk to find. I know from in 2017, I had the eclipse glasses where you can look at the partial eclipse. I can't seem to find them, but I know I will before either get more or find my pair that I do have.
They're usually pretty cheap. It's good to try and find them sooner rather than later, because most of the problem is they sell out as you get close to them.
Yes.
So try and find them soon, but they're not expensive.
I remember there was a bagel shop in New Jersey that was, if you bought a sandwich, they gave you eclipse glasses. And that's how I got them, actually.
Nice.
Where our office is. You mentioned how it does get cooler during this the solar eclipse. I'm interested from that aspect, from a meteorology aspect, is it several degrees cooler? I'm not sure exactly how much it does drop.
Yeah, it drops probably around about 10 degrees Fahrenheit drop. So it's definitely noticeable.
It'd be kind of neat, right, to take a look at the actual path, Mike, and look at what METARs are impacted like by the path of totality, and maybe just look at it.
Observation stations.
Yeah, and just kind of look and see what happened. Because we do have the 5-minute obs and stuff like that we can look at.
I do remember in 2017, we were watching the visible satellite, because you can – our satellites, you know, that are orbiting the Earth, you know, are always looking down, and you can see the physical shadow of the solar eclipse go across the Earth. And we did notice that there was a lot of cumulus clouds that were kind of bubbling up, because I think it was in...
Oh, yeah, I remember that. And then they stopped.
It was in August, I believe. So there was a lot of cumulus clouds, and they like to feed off of the heat from the earth that rises up and makes those clouds bubble like that. So when the eclipse went over, we noticed that the Q field kind of got diminished a little bit. It kind of, all those puffy clouds kind of thinned out and kind of dispersed a little bit. So it was interesting to see that, because typically you see those disappear when we get to sunset, obviously,
right?
Because we lose the sun. But to see that as the eclipse went by was quite interesting.
Right. And then once the eclipse went by, that I think they started to bubble back up before sunset.
They did.
Cool. Yeah, mainly down south. Yeah, where you get heat and humidity, and because that was August, so I was in the deep in the middle of summer.
Yeah, so they did. So I was, since we're talking about the science of what happens, is there any specific things that, you can look at that's, or observe, or any type of research opportunity that comes during a solar eclipse?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where I would return to what I said at the start about the difference between space weather and Earth weather. You just spoke about satellites that look at the Earth, and you see cloud cover, etc. So if you think about trying to predict the Earth weather, there's no way you can do that with only looking at the surface of the Earth, right? Just the ground and the oceans. You need to see the Earth's atmosphere. You need to see the clouds. You need to see these things progressing. And that's the same for the sun, right? We cannot predict space weather if we only look at the surface of the sun. We need to see the atmosphere of the sun. The problem is, though, that there's a big difference between the sun and the Earth, and that is that if you look down on the Earth, you'll see its atmosphere. You'll see its clouds. The sun, the surface is so bright that it drowns out the sun's atmosphere of the sun, so we don't see it. So the easiest way to see the sun's atmosphere is during an eclipse, where we block out the surface light and then we see the atmosphere. So that's called the corona. And if we can image the corona, if we can see how it's changing over time, then that's one of the most important ways to predict or to image space weather events. Like if there's an eruption coming off the sun, we need to see what direction it went, what speed it's going, to be able to predict when it will reach Earth and how it will affect the power grid, how it might affect GPS satellites, etc.
Since we're on that topic, and I have you, I'm interested a little bit, because recently, it might have been a couple of weeks ago, there was a couple of large flares that came off the sun. I think there were X magnitude flares, which I know are the highest kind of caliber. And I know they can affect the power grid and our communications and our satellites and things like that. I was always curious, well, how strong of a flare do we need to, like, not that I want one, I mean, obviously, but I'm just curious, how big of a flare do you need to really affect us and what we're doing with all our cell phones and everything else here?
In some sense, you do want one, because there's also some really cool effects, like the aurora. That's, we see the aurora when you get eruptions from the air, from the sun. So it's not always a bad thing. But to answer your question about how strong a one do we need, there's no simple answer there. It depends, right? And I should also say that there's a difference between a solar flare and a solar eruption. A solar flare is a burst of light, right? So that we see, that's often associated with an eruption. So at the same time as a flare, we often get an eruption of material, and that eruption of material is more important for affecting us on Earth. So those particles come towards the Earth. They're charged particles. They interact with our own magnetosphere and cause effects. So the size matters, absolutely, but also the direction of travel matters, right? Oftentimes these things will shoot out into outer space and they won't meet the Earth at all. So the direction is important. And it's very difficult to predict that. Even if we see the eruption happening on the sun, how exactly it will travel through space until it meets Earth is pretty hard to predict. We don't know how it will reach Earth, and if it will be a glancing blow or will it hit us directly. So this is still like a pretty active area of research. It used to be like maybe 100 years or so ago, the only effect of these things was the aurora, and you wouldn't know about it otherwise. But as we get more dependent on technology, we start to get more, we're more susceptible to these solar events. So you mentioned the power grid can be knocked out. The GPS
satellite. I know that's an extreme example.
That's an extreme example, but it has happened before, right? There's been sections of the power grid that have been like knocked out by solar storms. GPS satellites can be affected. And one thing that there's also like a lot of like financial impact of these things, right? Because solar weather coming from the sun affects drag on satellites up in space. So if there's a denser solar wind, satellites start to fall back to Earth quicker. So you need to give them more fuel to stay up there, and all that costs money. And also it can affect airline flights. They might not be able to fly over the poles during these events. They might have to take a long
route. Oh, yeah, because the GPS and stuff may get affected, right?
Yep. Yeah, and that has quite a big knock-on effect for airline companies like to know this, because they want to put as little fuel in their planes as possible, right? That's just a financial driver for them. So usually the shortest route between Europe and North America
is over the poles,
going close to the pole. But if you have to avoid the pole, then it's a longer route.
Yeah, I'm always worried about, I don't want to be fear-mongering, but I worry about the technology and stuff going down, what will happen to our society a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
Because I've been interested in space and weather like that, and I know that back in the 1800s, there was the Carrington event, which was some big, you know, mass ejection that you know a lot more of, but that I know was taking out the telegraph machines and things of those days. And I know we're more advanced than that at this point, but I guess what I don't know is, are our systems more or less susceptible to something like that nowadays? Are we kind of, you know, protected from that? Is there some type of way that we can mitigate the effects?
Yeah, I think the answer is good and bad there. Yes, we're more susceptible because we have more of these communication systems than they did in the 1800s. That was telegraph was like the only real thing that was affected back then. But nowadays we have so much more telecommunications. So even the electricity grid. So there's a potential to be, if one of these events came now, it would have much bigger impact on society. But at the same time, we know a lot more about them now than we did back then. So if we can see one of these events coming, we have the potential to take kind of mitigating responses to it. We can put satellites into safe mode. We can try and protect the power grid, for instance. So things are, we're getting better at being able to predict these events. We're not there yet, but we can get a little bit of lead time, at least a couple of days before the event reaches Earth. So,
well, sorry, we got a little bit out of the box there, Paul. But
well, maybe we can have Paul back on, and if he doesn't mind, one day, and we can talk more about the solar impacts and space weather and things like that, because that's a very, very interesting side of things for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't know, Paul, if you know more about the interactions between solar weather and how it affects our atmosphere, and you know that could be a whole nother topic if there's a lot to discuss there. I'm sure there is.
Yeah, we should talk again about this, because there's a whole lot to discuss on that topic.
I'm sure there is.
All right. Well, Paul, I really appreciate you being here on the podcast today. It's really great talking everything about the solar eclipse coming up here. I'm really excited about it. I think you've encouraged me to take a drive and get to where I need to be. So I'm excited for it. And as I know you and Brad are.
Yeah, you won't regret it. So I encourage you to go. And thanks for having me on. It's been great.
But that's it for our podcast. And remember, we'll have a new one every 2 weeks. So come back and listen again. And remember, weatherworksinc.com. That's where to find all the information you need to know about WeatherWorks and also social media. Just search WeatherWorks. You'll find us on just about every platform. That's it for this week's show. So thanks again for listening, everyone.